Can you hear me at the back?
No, but
otherwise I'll take it.
Okay, recording. Oh, you have to record it, so okay. Okay, then I'll take this out, even if it rings, so it will not make much sound. Okay, thanks for inviting me here, and it's a pleasure to be here at TIFR, having a good time meeting quite a few people. So I was not sure what type of audience and what type of lecture I'll be giving it, so I just put few things together, and it looks like whatever I put, there is somebody in the audience who will connect to that, so it's a sheer good luck for that. So today we'll discuss, look into the printed organic devices. What are the opportunities and challenges for a chemist? And so we'll discuss two different topics. One is the devices itself, and the second is how do you approach looking at the material synthesis? What are the new frontiers in that? So let's look into the first topic is the organic electronics, and that most of you are aware of it. You, as the time goes by, more and more of these devices are in the market, depending on which area. Any area you look into that, you'll always find an organic device. So the way we are going and we are living nowadays, we want everything to be available to us. Whether it's relevant or not is not really important. We want to know our heartbeat, we want to know our weight, we want to know everything we want to know. Whether it's correct or incorrect is also not relevant. We just want to know. I don't know why you want to know. So the feeling of having it is more important than really using it. And once everybody wants to have everything, the only way is to be commoditized. This one, and the commoditization can only happen when you have cheap devices. So pretty much I'm sure within few years down the line, your mobile devices will be your labs. Diagnostic labs, blood test to sugar to BP to heart, whatever you want to check it, has to develop in a mobile device. So that's the platform which is going to be the one, and the devices will be printed directly from there. And so that's the area we'll look into that. And that question everybody asks, organic versus inorganic. And there are both advantages and disadvantages of both sides. I don't think there is any competition between the two, because the domains in which they are looking at are very, very different. So when you're looking at inorganic based devices, they are not going to be outdated anytime in near future. The purity and everything what you're looking at, so whenever you look at the high-end devices, this is what's going to happen. And whenever you're going to look at the commodity devices, where you want to use it once or twice, more for fun than for use, you are going to rely on cheap material. And the cheap material will come on based on organic devices. But there's still a lot more issues over here. It's easier said than done. This, over the last 5 to 6 decades, we have reached a stage where you can get this 6 to 7 times purity. And you can actually, if a chemist tell them that I have a material which is 99.9% pure, to them it's very, very pure. But from a device side, that's extremely impure material we are still dealing with. So this, all these organic materials which we talk, the moment you look into this material, you really can't talk of this type of purity. Particularly the tools are also not there. All the tools which are developed over here can assure you of this quality, which is not there on organic devices. But they're much cheaper. But reason here why they are not there is the application also has not been evolved, and I'll discuss that. So whenever you look at the organic material, there are a lot of question marks on purity as well as batch-to-batch variability. But if something comes out, this is the way it becomes cheaper and better. So the way one looks into that is, with time, anything which you take it from earth or not renewable will keep on becoming more expensive, and organic will become cheaper with time. So more you use it, cheaper it will become. Better chemists will come up, better processes will come up. So once this use picks up, you will have better and better material based on this. These are the various devices, it's still there. This is the most recent, not very recent, but few months old. You have the flexible LEDs and you have the flexible batteries. All that organic devices which you are seeing, they're called organic, but they're still made in facilities which are better than the semiconductor facilities. Okay, no LED will work if you make it in open. The idea of organic devices was you print them directly, but right now no successful device other than few photovoltaics are there which are printed directly in a commercial press. The whole idea of organic devices, if at all someday is important, is all your printing machineries which are there in neighborhood should be capable of printing those devices. That's the ultimate one is looking for. So people will supply ink, You want to make a photovoltaic, you just go to the next shop, that way you get for visiting card, get your design done and print it and then use it. Same in LEDs. So that stage will come, but that stage is still not there. So all the success is still through very high-end facilities, and that's the reason it's still very expensive in that. You can have stretchable batteries, flexible electronic. This is the most recent product in organic electronics, which is directly printed now. Still printed in little sophisticated facilities, but this is very close to reality. There's a company called Infinity PV from Denmark company, where now you can buy this organic printed cells of defined efficiency. So you define what module, what range you want, and you can place order online and you can get it. Day before yesterday, this has been launched. It's a mobile charger. So the charger will come like this. And then you, whenever you are there, you just connect the cable to that and just pull this up. Whenever you are sitting in open, you just let this device to charge. So this is a practical solution now, and more of these common man use is where the issue will come up. And all these devices, most of the times, are not being promoted because the technology which goes in is generally quite advanced, and that's only available in the Western countries. And whenever you look at that, they always compare what is the cost of replacing the electricity. There, the no question asked about the availability of the electricity, the grid. So the capital cost of the grid is much higher. So the places where there's no electricity available, only sun and air, these devices will find an application. But that does business sense does not still excite them. So right now these are all available for high-end use, but I'm more than positive the first next door neighbor printed device will be the organic photovoltaics. Is not that far, but will happen sometime soon. Various ways of printing, these are the conventional printing which happens every corner of the earth, everywhere, and this has to be implemented, and this is what has been used now. So this is the printed solar cell of the Infinity PV. They are roll-to-roll printing, they are slot die coating. It's a combination of various printing things, and the guy who is pushing this very hard is Professor Krebs. He's one of the highly cited scientists. Every other day he writes a paper, and it's amazing. I don't know how he works, and every email you send to him, he replies also. So it's not easy to sustain that patience, and the emails are generally personally replied. I have tried, I thought somebody else will be sitting there and replying the emails. So he asks strange questions, but he replies that. So he has a huge group working with them with large funding. So if you type this, I think he's one of the highly cited scientists in this area, and is like the whatever he says has just been listened. So whenever you look into the organic devices, you are looking at transparent conductor is one. If you, whenever you look for interacting with the light, you only one device, one electrode has to be transparent. Whenever the light either has to come out or go in, so you need a transparent conductor if you are looking at optical electronic device. Otherwise, you need an active layer, whether you are N-type, P-type or both, and then your hole transport and electron transport layers, so all these multi-layer structures, you look into that. And as a chemist, sky is the limit. You can, that's a beauty, you can think of a structure and the chemist will make it. And they'll make it only once and you won't get it again because there's no interest in that. Unless and until there's a huge at stake, because you can publish only one paper at a time. If you're Chinese, there is a reason to publish again, but otherwise you publish one at a time, and if you publish one at a time, chemist, there is no excitement. So the first material will be made in no time, few milligrams, because few milligrams is a lot to a chemist. They'll do all studies and recover 1 milligram out of that. You talk to an electrical engineer, we want a device to be made. Can we try devices? Yeah, give me some 10 gram of the material. After device, then they say, okay, now let's talk a real device. So where's the material? So whereas chemists can deal with 2 milligram of the material, do all the studies and still retain 1 milligram back, which is an amazing thing. That's the reason. But this is important. Once the chemists make it and then the structures become important, you will have better and better chemists making it cheaper and cheaper. That's the reason cost can only go down, cannot go up. Right now the costs are prohibitively high. So this infinite, this is a very interesting paper came last year. All structures which are monomers which are listed here in terms of donor, acceptor and other things. So I'll give you the structures, look at these structures and look at these structures. These are still limited structures and combinations of them will give you infinite number of materials. And that's the beauty we call in chemistry. Once you know area, it's...
Sorry.
Sure.
Are these all the monomer units of the polymer or These are just, in general, these are units that are being used for the device.
No, most of them are monomers, because some of them you can use it, but you can look at all are dibromo. All are dibromo, so they have been used, or all are tin, or so they all are either dibromo or ditin or diselenide. Ready for the coupling. Okay. And once you have these series, everybody can make, and this is still not the end of the chemistry, okay? There are still too many elements in the periodic table, there are still too many R groups. There is no limit. Okay, so early, every time it starts, first thing when your new area starts, you just make every structure and study its property. Then after certain time, in this case, we reach a saturation stage where you can't say I made a new structure. Now enough information is available that you need to design a structure. Once you design a structure, then you show its application, and if that is not there, then you can't publish it. That's the reason the organic electronic chemistry area is becoming harder to publish, because you need to design a structure, you need to make that structure, that alone is not enough. Then you need to make a device, then study the device, and then do. That's the reason you have large number of authors in any papers which you look into that. So that low hanging fruit, the time is over, but still, there's still, you can see looking into that.
Why does everything has bromine?
Because that's a coupling. To make the polymer, is there a carbon-carbon bond formation has to happen. For carbon-carbon bond formation, the Suzuki Stille couplings are the most easier way to do that. And that's the reasons of the partner. If you look at the bromo couples with the tin or the silyl, so tin will give you Suzuki coupling, and that's the standard way of right now making. Or you can add chain that. So it's a way a chemist looks into building a carbon-carbon bond. So Suzuki is one of the very extensively used method to look into that. That's the reason all will have either bromine or tin, but you can have boronic acid or the Komoda coupling and look into that. So there's a synthetic limitation.
And how expensive are these? You are saying this is very expensive.
Very expensive is always relative. So if you are earning in dollar, it's not very expensive, but India price will be very expensive. So each one, if you have a polymer, like a PCDTBT, which is used extensively, or a PTB7, these are abbreviations, people use it, you are looking at the price of $2,000 a gram. Okay, but if you talk to bio people, their fluorescent dyes will cost you $75,000 a 100 milligram. So it depends on whom you are dealing with and what are you dealing with. So don't look at this number so strangely. I knew the moment I said $2,000 a gram, they will look into that. Get a green fluorescent molecule with a, it will cost you 100,000, still looking at milligram quantity. Gram unit is still very far from. So depending on the application. But to me, they're still expensive. And reason expensive is everybody needs it, they will be making it in order. Okay, made to order. Right now there's no use. There's a, I'll show you that slide which will come soon. So this is what happens. Now you're looking at large area application in the device, which means somebody has to print these things. You want to print it, you need a kilogram of the ink. Okay, now you develop all your printing. First you need a kilogram of the ink, and after you think that is done, you need another kilogram to try the repetition. The next ink won't be the same. Okay, so the batch to batch variation is huge. Even the best commercial supplier, the 1M material, if you buy the best material twice, it's a completely different material which you'll come out with. Okay, the papers written on that the molecular weight changes, the rigid regularity changes. So depending on who makes it, things will be different. Okay, and everything matters over here. Okay, this is one example I'm showing, beautiful review article written. Single material P3HT with PCBM started in 2001. Number of papers on same material, same device. Look at the power conversion efficiencies everywhere. Okay. Look at the publications, how many have increased, and look at the same, nothing has changed. You have the same P3HT, same PCBM, make device out of photovoltaic, and every group which makes it will have a different number.
Okay. What are the blue ones?
Let to look into this. So these are device number, but I think year wise they're just staggering in the year wise. Okay, so that clarity becomes easier, which year in between your large number of publication 2008-9. Okay, and this is the efficiency number of publication. So if you look at the efficiency around 4, between 3 and 4 you have large number of publication. There are some weird publication with efficiencies of 7% in P3HT, 1 or 2 that ICBA combination of that. The large on this side, but average around 2 to 4%, you get large number of publication onto that. And when somebody starts into that area, if they can make a 2-3% device in the very first year, that's a quite a good progress in that direction once you start into these devices. And depending on which solvent and what you process, at the end, this is what I said, is it science or art or both? Okay, so it's like cooking. You have, can give the same ingredient, same recipe to 10 people, but the food of the, all the 10 will taste different. Okay, so both the science and the art goes in these devices, and it's a talent which needs to be doing over there. So this is where the bottleneck in this area is. You want this large area, large number, cheap devices. For that you require large number or large amount of material, and for having a large amount of material you require large amount of application. If the applications are not there, materials don't be made. If materials are not made, application won't come. So somewhere this cycle has to break, somewhere business model has to come. The moment business model comes in, you will have a immediate best of the chemists will make cheaper and cheaper material. So all these things have to combine efficiency, lifetime cost, and all this should be reproducible in order to get this. And that's the real bottleneck right now, because to a chemist, applications are not there, so there's no business model in scaling it up. And they are saying we can't scale up because the quantities are not available. So it's a catch-22 situation, but somewhere breakthrough and somewhere breakout will happen. So this is where we came into picture after working many years into these devices. We looked into, is it possible now as a chemist, can you look into making materials which are reproducible every time you make it with better control? Same thing happens not in organic electronics. You can take quantum dots, you can take nanoparticles. Every batch to batch you make it is going to be different. Okay, it's amazing. There are papers written on, if you take this cadmium selenide with zinc selenide coating, it's so many papers, and they still say that if your student can make successfully in a first year, it's a big achievement. And full process is given, slight impurity, slight changing will just completely change. Same is dye-sensitized solar cell. If you talk to Mike Grezel, every device he makes it at 10-11%. And you ask a question, how did you make the device, your publication, all the process is there, but we can't make it. Then he says, yeah, it costs $50,000. Come to my lab, I'll teach you how to make it. So there are art and the real, it's like a gharana which goes into making these devices. And without that part of that gharana, you can't really get there in the devices. So that's so we decided, can we now look into all these areas?
But those gharanas will become very rich.
So they are anyway rich. Each one has a company and each one has a supply of this material, and we have no choice. So we were very old gurukuls and everything. It's not easy to get into any of those gurukuls anyway. So you pretty much have to become slave to that, and then you get into that. So that's always true. I think science is no different, that having that everybody is independent works to a level. Freedom and independence come, but rigorous work does require both of you work as a slave and just get that going. Hard work really is really must. You have to be lucky, but to be lucky you have to work very hard. So you can't be lucky if you are not working very hard. So that goes in every, anything you want to do good, it needs a lot of effort. Unless you are brilliant sitting on some moon roof and then suddenly something came up. So the theoretical idea is okay, and then you can try to prove it. That's not easy, but experimental work is very, very hard and requires a lot of hard work. More and more, that's the reason hard to find physical chemists, experimental physical chemists now. How many students now are there who can be trained to build up things from scratch? Building up that whole is still a physics domain. Chemists have slowly forgotten everything to build up instrumentation. Physics guys are still doing it, but chemists have completely forgotten how to assemble anything now. Sorry, it's just the way it is. They all use instruments. You can even ask a chemist student, why are you using deuterated solvent in an NMR? Half of them in IIT can't even reply. They have no idea. They put the tube, they get the data, there's a software which processes it. They know. Nowadays, software is even assigns the peak. So it's becoming so handicapped. So technology helps, but technology can also make you very handicapped. So it's a pitfall of that. So we look into this system, and so we'll take a little detour from the organic devices and come into something called paradigm shift in last decade in how a chemist looks into the synthesis. We call it a continuous flow synthesis. And the idea here is you can now design what you want, and whenever you want, it will be the same. So it's a dial-in synthesis, like a peptide synthesizer or something, and every time you get very good control over that. So we started a huge program, and the reason this is still not picked up in India, when we started 3 years back, there was only one lab in NCL, Chemical Engineering Lab of Professor Ranade and Amol Kulkarni, who were doing flow synthesis. Only one lab in the country. Because everything is chemical engineering in terms of assembling the reactors and fabricating it. But heart of it, the chemistry has to be evolved. So chemical engineer good in assembling everything, but chemistry, new chemistry cannot be developed. Chemists are very good in new chemistry, but don't want to touch anything other than RB. Round bottom flask, conical flask, or a condenser. Very, very hard. Tell them, give them a spanner. First they will, what is quarter 28 thread? What do you mean? They don't even know their HPLC fitting. Forget about anything else. How many of you use HPLC and tell me one threading from column to that? What's the size of the tube? What's the ID, OD, and where do you find the tube? They're just not interested in. So this field becomes very difficult in India because we are clumsy with hands. But that's what we decided 3 years. We worked and then we said, no, let's try learning it. So let's look into why this is important. Let's take a little detour to the theory. So if you look at a chemical reaction, there are two ways you look into the chemical reaction. A chemist will look into a macroscopic view of the chemical reaction, where every day they do in the lab and the plant. And there's another way of doing the looking at the reaction is molecular level view, where is the reaction dynamics, where Professor Javel got the Nobel Prize for this. What they say, the same thing happens. You have a reactant, it goes through a transition stage and activation energy, there's a gain in energy, and that the reaction happens. But both of them say very different thing. A chemist will always say reaction takes, minimum for a chemist reaction takes 12 hours. Why? Because that's where evening you set up and morning you come, is 12 hours are gone. So this is a standard way. You take any chemistry literature, 12 hours it does take a chemical reaction. Okay. If the chemist is good, few hours will happen. Those few hours have been between breakfast and lunch, or a lunch and dinner. So you see, it has to be at the end, somebody has to work and monitor. Okay, but look at the molecular level, every reaction, your rotational motion which happens in this nano to picosecond, your vibrational motion, and according to Ahmad Javel and everybody, the reactions do happen in nano to picosecond. Okay, so typically a reaction will happen in a nano to picosecond. Of course, you are talking of gas phase reactions where the molecules are in the gas phase and then you react. So if the molecules have to react, reaction will happen in a picosecond or a femtosecond. But why it happens in a flask much longer? Because now you have molecules which are in solvents. So you have two molecules which are solvated, they are in a cage. First, they have to diffuse it through the flask length, and if you have a reactor, they take much longer. Then they have to first get into the same cage. Once they get into the same cage, then they have the same energy, same efficiency, everything has to match. So all this societal contribution is so large that the reactions won't happen in real time. Okay, but actually it's a blessing in disguise. You don't want that reaction to happen at femtosecond, because in a flask or in a reactor you are doing a 1 ton reaction or a 1 kg reaction. If that reaction happens in a femtosecond, it will be an explosion. Okay, so you have both plus and minus, that you don't want that reaction to happen so fast that it should not be runaway reaction. But that does not mean you take an extreme and that reaction happens for so long. So somewhere in between, one has to look into that, and that's what we have been looking. So molecular level reaction happens very fast. Flask chemistry happens much, much farther. And the only reason why there's nothing available in between is, we still don't know as a technological solutions, how do you take this heat out very efficiently? The moment you learn how to take this heat out very efficiently, there is no reason that you have to wait for hours for the reaction to happen. You should be in a position to let the reaction happen in millisecond to second. So you reach a stage now called the flow process or a flash chemistry. your flash photolysis, flash kinetics. Now there's a term called flash photolysis, flash chemistry, where reactions will happen from millisecond to second. And the reason that happens is, I'll show you a flow processes where now you can extract the heat much faster by using microfluidics. And that's the reason now chemistry can happen much faster and much more reproducible way compared to anything else. Okay. So then the question is, why do you want to conduct the reaction at an extremely fast rate? There has to be serious benefits to that. And these are the ways we look into. Very, very fast way of doing the synthesis of the libraries. There are a lot of probes in biomedical imaging which are radioactive. They need to be prepared on site. Okay, so those tools, if they can prepare very fast, you can use it, prepare very fast, as much as you need it, you don't need to store it. Cost, and then the best thing, or the worst which happens, you keep hearing this accident, the recent one in China, that chemical plant, that chemical storage unit which got fire. Bhopal is still, we are debating Bhopal tragedy. All these tragedies happen because the intermediates, so you require a large volume of the final product. That final product may be three-step synthesis, but the second and third step can have a chemical which is hard to handle. But since you require large step in a ton scale, you need to make the intermediate at ton scale. So methyl isocyanide or anything else you want to make it, will be very large scale, you have to make it, store it, because that's what you want to do. And that becomes extremely difficult. So with this method now, you don't need to make and store the intermediates. And that's the reason this is becoming very, very important and very powerful tool. You generate those intermediate online, on spot, and use them on spot. And you don't need to store them. And this method now you can scale up. So this is what pretty much typically a chemist will look into that. This is a batch reaction. Whereas a continuous flow reaction, you do through this one and then do that. It's nothing new. It's more than hundreds of year chemical engineers have been doing continuous flow reaction through various tubes. What has suddenly changed in the last 8 to 10 years is, lot of these tools, so these are the benefits. You can have microfluidic channels, everything becomes much more better and much easier. What happened? Okay. Why did it stop? Okay, so this is the way it happens, and if you look at how the chemistry has evolved, this is the traditional way of doing that, and this is the modern way of doing it. Instead of using the flask, now we use the microfluidic channels. And the reason for that, big things happen, as I told you earlier, for these processes chemistry has to be evolved differently. So new chemistry has to be designed now which is compatible with these microfluidic reactors. Now, microfluidic or the continuous flow is a chemical engineering process. A chemistry is a chemist's domain. So unless and until a chemical engineer starts doing a chemistry, or a chemist start assembling the chemical engineering processes, this marriage will not happen. So till few years back, all these processes were done in large industries where you can afford to take large flow reactors. But now, last 8 to 10 years, most of these reactors have been converted into small devices which are off the shelf available. Once these are off the shelf available, a chemist can start developing chemistry based on this. Once a chemistry guy starts developing chemistry, once chemistry is known, the process can be scaled up. And that's the reason you see, they're still a little expensive, but you can buy them off the shelf now. So you can buy most of these, there are 6-7 companies I listed, and each of these reactors can be bought now online, and the chemistry can be developed into that. And the advantage of most of this is, as I told you, each one of them is a scalable platform, which means once you, till date, when a chemist finishes a reaction at a 1 gram or to 10 gram scale in the lab, the moment the chemist does it at a 100 gram, it doesn't work the same way. And the moment you do a 1 kilogram, it doesn't work. And that, so that's the reason then you require Reynolds number, you require heat capacities, there's so many parameters. That's where chemical engineering comes. Even when a chemical engineer designs it, every time you change the size, it's a new problem to solve it. However, this does not the case with the flow synthesis. Once a chemist have designed a process, The scalability is linear. You don't need to know any other parameter, because you are never going to cross the domain of surface to volume ratio. Is always going to be in your favor. There's no mechanical part which is moving. Everything is built into. So this is big change for the chemists now. We call it chemists are the king now. You design the reaction, tomorrow you start a factory. You don't need anything in between anybody's help. You directly now can do, which is not the case earlier. Whereas now chemical engineer has to learn chemistry to do that. So once you have these tools, so these are all the scalable tools which you can buy. Now this can give you few tons a month production. And there are various reactors, and I'll show you reactors. This is a whole chemical plant now. This is a few mode, which is a standard few mode of the lab. You can make 10,000 liters per day processing through these reactors now. You put another room, whatever strong room you want of any quality, put all your reagents there. You just need piping to these two reactors, which are in a few mode, and both are computer controlled. And then product comes out, you collect in another room. Anything ever goes wrong, there's a sensors built into that, it will stop that. So anytime something goes wrong, your runaway reaction will be 50 ml, 100 ml or 1 liter maximum. Even if you are doing 10,000 liter batch, your runaway reaction is only related to 1 liter, the largest one. So the safety is paramount in this case. And think of, if you go and visit any chemical plant, every chemical plant has a ice plant next to it. And the roof is mandatory, and the roof is stacked with a truckload of ice. The only way they follow a reaction, the moment they realize the reaction is little bit out of control, the only way they do is dump the whole truckload of ice into that and finish it. And that's huge loss in terms of production and everything. That will all be eliminated. And that's the beauty, and that's the reason everybody is shifting now towards the flow process. So we started looking into the flow process, and bad luck as it happens, chemists always take the wrong approach. We took the toughest reaction to do with the flow, because we didn't know what is flow chemistry. So we were doing P3ST synthesis, so it's a regirregular poly-3-axial thiophene, where this is the structure which I was telling. If all these side chains are in the same direction, they pack much better. And that's a material which is of good quality. But when we looked into this, this is how it is made. It's just a simple chemistry using a Komoda coupling is one. Here you require bromoiodo, which couples with itself. That's why you don't require tin or stilicup or the TMS group over here. But the disadvantage, very well-known process. Everything is known. You can get molecular weight. Whatever you want to control can be controlled in a lab. But that does not happen when you scale up this reaction. There's one defect which starts with this. There's two R groups which are located opposite to each other. After that, you have everything regular. So there are always going to be inherent one defect into the chain which is going to build up.
What do you mean by defect?
So defect is these two R groups are not located on the same side. See, if you look at this, R groups are all located on this side. But these two orientation is different.
That is the one you wanted.
No, we want all of them to be on the same side.
Why have that? You can have the other type of configuration there.
So that is not possible in the synthesis. So in the synthesis, which is easy to do, the starting point will be this dimer, because the way the chemistry evolves, after this dimer, all the R group will be this side and all the R group will be on this side. So there is a connecting point where two regirregular chains are connected, and that is irregular. Okay. So that is the inherent nature of the system. That's how it does. The people have been working on it and trying to resolve what is the issue with that. So we looked into this reaction. If you look into, there are many companies which are commercially supplying this, but every time you buy it, it's a different material. And because the batch-to-batch variation is huge, and we looked into this method, and very first thing came to our mind, this reaction is extremely fast. The moment you add catalyst, within second the reaction is finished. Now, the catalyst which you are adding is a solid in a solution, and the reaction finishes in seconds. And catalyst will always be a powder. Does not matter how much fine you can grind it, you are still looking at micron particle. In a micron particle, you still have millions of molecules. So what will happen? The surface molecules will react first, and they will see a different concentration of monomer than the next surface and the next surface. So the heterogeneity gets built into, because you are adding solid as a catalyst. So we looked into, can this be changed if at all you want the reproducible material. And another thing which happens, which I tell a lot of students, lot of things can be solved just by looking at the problem. You really don't have to come out with very witty answers. You keep looking at the problem continuously, you will always find a solution in that. Same thing we did, this Komoda coupling is known from 1972. And it's a very standard reaction. You take this catalyst, don't worry about this, just a ligand on that. You take two equivalent of Grignard, it forms the oxidative addition, then reductive elimination. And this is how this sequence goes in. All your Suzuki and Stille coupling are known palladium catalyzed. The catalytic cycle goes from palladium 0, palladium 2, palladium 0, palladium 2 continuously. And same thing has been accepted for this one. It goes through nickel 0, nickel 2, nickel 0, nickel 2, nickel 0, nickel 2. This is nickel 2, this is nickel 0. It continuously goes on. And exactly well accepted from 1972. Till date, nobody has ever shown that nickel 0 exists. Okay, palladium 0, so furthermore, you can't, and if it's a nickel 0, nickel 2 continuous cycle, you should be in a position to enter that cycle either through nickel 2 or nickel 0. Palladium case, you can enter through palladium 0 or palladium 2. In nickel 0, you cannot do the reaction with nickel 0. So if you add nickel 0, reaction won't happen. You have to add nickel 2. Nickel 0 cannot be determined experimentally, but the only best possible mechanism is catalytic cycle of nickel 0, nickel 2. Okay. So everything works is a hypothesis. People accepted it. We looked into this and we realized that if this reaction has to happen, there has to be a formation of nickel 0. Then nickel 0 again gets inserted and then do that. Only issue was nickel 0, if you add, nothing happens to a reaction. We said there could be something different about the nickel 0 which forms into the system. So we said, why don't you use the same chemistry and generate nickel 0 first using the same Grignard. Don't use your monomer as a Grignard. Okay, this is the monomer as a Grignard. We said you use first hexyl Grignard. Generate this nickel 0 which otherwise would have generated in the reaction and then add your monomer. Don't take a monomer and add nickel 0 pure. We said let's generate this in situ. We did that and to our surprise, we found a polymer which formed. Every time you do this reaction, you form this polymer. And this polymer now, if you look at the very first step, was a nickel 2 adding to give you to nickel 0. So defect was from the very first step, which was not part of the catalytic cycle over here. And in our case, since we are now starting with the nickel 0, we don't have the first defect. And this is the first time we have shown now, you can get 100% rigid regular poly-3-acyl-thiophene directly from this method. And it took us almost 2 years to solve this problem. So we first tried dissolving the catalyst. We could find a solvent in the catalyst dissolved and we could do flow synthesis. But that was become too expensive. We finally just made the same thing. Take the same catalyst, take the same monomer. You just add 1% of the Grignard, generate nickel 0 in the flask and add your monomer and everything just works. And you get 100% rigid regular. These materials are highly crystalline. They have very unusual property. So we are studying them now, mostly P3HT, if somebody has handled it, it's a nice powder, you get it. But if you look at the materials which we have carpets now. They are nice green metallic luster carpet, which you have to cut it with a scissor. Okay, they are so high molecular weight, they pack so well. So the couple of papers which are going to come, and now we can make polydisperses of 1.1, 1.12 in a flow synthesis. In a batch, we get 1.4 to 1.5. Okay. So then, now the whole idea here is, the beauty of a flow synthesis is, you are taking two reagents, they meet at a point and they move forward. Which means, once the reaction has happened, the product is never going to see the fresh reagent. In a batch, you have a whole lot and you keep adding one reagent, second reagent is in this one. Or you add two reagents together, reaction happens. But the product stays at the same place, where your reagents are going to come in. Plus the mixing is very, very inefficient. So we looked into now the chemistry, wherever the reproducibility is a problem, whether quantum dots, nanoparticles or polymer, the main problem is your mixing sites are very different and your product, the concentration gradient in your system is very large, which is does not happen in flow. So it's a tricky, but if you address this, you can do wonderful flow chemistry. And I'll show you another example on polyaniline nanofibers. What happens, this is what the literature known, if you take polyaniline is the easiest polymer to make. You take aniline, cheapest material, put it in water, put acid and oxidizing agent, ammonium persulfate, and you just ammonium peroxide disulfate, you got a polymer. Beautiful. As old as 100 to 200 year old process of making polyaniline. 2004, this McDermott and Sanjeev Manohar's group showed that if you take the same solution, you add a carbon nanotube or you add any other nanoparticle into that as a seed. Everything you grow in a polyaniline, you become nanofibers. It's no more a bulk material. That was very wonderful paper which came into this. They call it a seeding method. Then in 2007, Richard Kenner from UCLA showed that actually it's beyond that. What he showed that if you take an interfacial polymerization, don't stir the system, at the interface you'll only always form nanofiber. So he said nanofibers, you don't require a seed. You can just do an interfacial polymerization. The process is very slow. You get very less quantity. But immediately next year, or a couple of years down the line, he gave completely different hypothesis. What he said is, when you have a monomer and when you add an oxidizing agent to the monomer, the very first nucleus which form, they are all nanofibers. And since those nanofibers stay in the solution, you have more oxidizing agent, more monomer, this acts as a nuclei, and later on what you get is a powder. So what he has shown very nicely, that if you mix it vigorously and stop it very fast, you will only get nanofiber. And if you let this go on, you will get this particle. So if you stop the reaction at 5 to 10 or 15% conversion, you will only have 100% nanofiber. And you let this go on, you will get the particles in. And that's why this wonderful, so now, once we saw this paper, life becomes easy now. Flow process actually replicates exactly what it wants. It wants now extremely fast mixing. It does not want secondary growth, which means that once the fibers are formed, they should not see the fresh aniline and fresh oxidizing agent. In the flow, exactly everything happens. And to our surprise, this concept has not been even tried. So flow is known for 5-7 years. Nobody thought that this could be possible. We did that exactly. And every time we do now, we get kilograms of this fiber in 70 to 80% yield. And now we are extending the same concept to quantum dots and other nanoparticles, that every time you make them, you will get the same one. So this is the flow process. We hope to get much longer results into this. And now the same thing happens in any other chemical process. So bromination is a very classical case where you require specialized equipment to handle bromine. Waste has to be recirculated. It's very difficult to let that waste go. Now we have developed a process by which you use as a bromine and brominating agent in water, and you get a selective bromination through continuous flow process at room temperature. This we are taking into industrial scale process, and hopefully we'll set up a plan looking into this. Now let's look into organic devices, a little bit back from the flow synthesis, couple of devices before we wind it up. Explosive sensor is what we have been dealing with for last 6 to 7 years. So how a chemist will look into explosives are the way it's defined. Your nitroaromatics, nitriamines, esters and peroxides, and now people are using ammonium nitrate and other things here. Explosives are nothing, they are nice organic compounds. You can handle them, kilograms of it. You can burn them, whatever you want to do them. Only don't provide a mechanical shock. Don't hit that with a hammer, or don't confine them and hit or burn them. If you burn them in a field, you can take a truckload and burn, nothing will happen. The why that happens is, look into this. The vapor pressure is very low. If you burn this explosive, first thing you hear whenever there's an explosion happens, they will say lot of nails were found, lot of metal balls were found. So what exactly happens is, when these are confined, so what terrorist people do is, they make this explosive, put them in a compact system and cover it with metal balls. Now when this explosion happens, when the burning happens, the speed at which this heat which is evolved and the waste which propagate is very, very fast. Look at this. So if you fire a bullet from an M16 rifle, speed of the sound is 343 meters per second. Fire this at the nozzle, at the point of starting is 975 millimeter per second. When these explosive burn or detonate in a confined system, the sound waves which expand, they expand at the speed of your, the waves, the 7 to 10,000 meters per second. Now think, you have an explosion or the burning of this explosive happens, all the metal balls on all the sides, the moment is going to burn and explode, these metal balls are going to thrown out at a speed of 10 times the faster than an M16 rifle. In all 360 degree direction, there is no weapon which can fire that many bullets in a millisecond or a split second in that many direction. And these metal balls, when they fly, they just pierce through everything comes on the way. So the damage is because of this huge detonation velocity which it creates. And all of them have very low vapor pressure, so difficult to detect them. So we have been, so defense approach has some 6 years back, can you look into your organic conjugated polymers as a fluorescent markers for detecting these explosives? And fluorescent means everything, if you have fluorescent molecules, they fluoresce very nicely in solution. The moment you put them in a solid state, they don't fluoresce because the self-quenching happens. So we design, or the designs known in chemistry by which you can make the molecules which don't aggregate. And if they don't aggregate, they'll fluoresce in solid state. And there's few molecules which are known. So earlier we started using, exploring this. We made various clickable derivatives, which means now you can make any biological or a chemical sensor based on that. And that's what we are working. The very first product we developed with a company, Big Tech Labs in Bangalore, is a complete handheld device, which now can detect TNT and RDX in real time. This device was tested 2 years back in Republic Day Parade in Delhi. Now we got this Center for Internal Security. The next step is now, is a problem with the development of these devices is when you start developing, the antisocial elements have much better resources and time with their favor. So earlier TNT was used extensively. By the time these devices come into, now they start moving to RDX. Now most recent one is ammonium nitrate. And ammonium nitrate is a fuel and a fertilizer. Where are you going to track it? It's always going to be in sacks. So their systems move much faster than the scientists who can track them. So there's a requirement now, can we make the same device for all types of substance abuse? So now platform device is ready. We need to develop the materials based on that, and that's the next phase we are working on. We also looked into transparent conductors. The easiest way is graphenes have been looked into, carbon nanotubes have been looked into. ITO is the standard way, everybody uses it. And again, the cost of ITO goes up, but then this cost of ITO goes up is a relative term because it looks like the cost of silicon and ITO actually is decreasing with time because your production skills become better and Chinese come into picture and they flood everything. And then there is no way. There are foundries in Germany of this silicon fabs which are completely useless because the fab in China, you can't just compete with that. So same thing, ITO is happening. We have been talking of that ITO will be replaced. Very soon carbon nanotubes came, graphene, but it's not getting replaced because more the threat happens, the price the vendor reduces. Because for supplier of ITO, it's a question of survival. It's no more a question of making huge profit. Whereas there is very interesting business model nowadays work. If you approach a company saying that I can make your the product which you have, I have another product which is better and cheaper, they say we are not interested in. Why? You go ahead and do it, you'll die natural death. Because you can't compete with so long we have been surviving. By chance, if you have resources and everything and you survive, then we'll buy you 100 times later. Why put 1 rupee now? Because anyway you're going to die, why should I waste one? But if you become a threat after persistent and this, we'll buy you at 100 rupees, we don't mind. So business model allows you that. So ITO has been selling now very cheap the moment they know their carbon nanotubes and this are coming. But how long that will go is a business model. So we have been looking into making these transparent conductors based on this E-dot, which is a blue ink which you get. And this is the way, every time you look at a transparent conductor, the physics people have come out with definition, where you give transparency and conductivity together, you relate. And this factor is called, we call now is a the figure of merit. Higher this number, sigma ratio we call it, is better the material is. Anything is a transparent conductor, this value should be for this graphene or something is 25. For ITO it is around 300 or odd number. Okay, for graphene and single layer carbon nanotubes you have this figure of merit is 25 right now. So this is based on P dot as a transparent conductor. These numbers were available from the literature, And now we have reached very close to these values. And now we have a very simple process. You buy this commercially available dispersion, you spin coat it, then you add PTSA, paratoluene sulfonic acid in DMSO, just spin on top of it, heat it to 110, and you're done. You get extremely highly conducting and transparent materials. So we now think this as a viable way of replacing this, and this becomes very interesting. Again, somebody has to now develop the whole process in a scalable, take this, develop applications, and then become threat to ITU. Otherwise, this just stays as it is. Okay, but looks like there's a huge potential. Some students have to take interest and then move it in this direction. So now this is what this rating. So we have this figure of merit going up to 135, 140 is one of the highest one known. We get very high conductivity, and we are now trying to do this, trying to develop applications on wherever the ITU has been used. So first application we are trying is electrochromic devices based on that, and hopefully that will happen soon. And this number is very high, but there's a issue, there's an ionic liquid which you can add to that solution. The moment you add this ionic liquid, you get a very high grade material, thin film from there. But the only issue here is when you add the ionic liquid, you only have few seconds window to process it, because the dispersion just falls out. So if you can process it in within a second, you get this type of values. So that's, but this process is much more handy and scalable based on that. So this is what pretty much I have two themes to discuss: the organic devices as well as the flow synthesis, and various students and various people come into picture. And lucky that we had this national centers started at IIT that give you a lot of freedom in terms of flexible delivery. So the device deliverable is frozen, but in the background of this device deliverable, you can develop a lot of innovative research if you are keen to do that. So all our flow chemistry tools, which require large amount of money, have been developed in the background using the device as our main deliverable. And the device was funded first through the Center for Excellence in Nanoelectronics and National Center for Photovoltaics. Now we got another large funding for this internal security. And that large funding means we will be in a position to go commercial with our flow devices and demonstrate and show it to the industry. And our idea is to next 2 to 3 years, at least 8 to 10 commercial processes we want to convert into a flow and make them safer and economically viable. So this is wonderful. The big tech labs where the explosive detector has come. Sycon Polymers is a startup company which we have floated based on this flow synthesis, where we now provide P3HT, which was available at $300 a gram. And every time it's different. Now we give a kilogram batches, and if you buy 1 gram, we give it at $100, which is 6,000 rupees. Anybody can afford it. It's a defect free, very high molecular weight. And our idea is if you have an application, you require a kilogram, this should be available at $20 to $25 a gram. Okay, so the idea here is if an application evolves, we can scale up our process to as low as $10 a gram, from $400, $300 a gram to that. Now let's see how the application evolves. So Sycon Polymer is a startup company which we have, and will develop more process. Ceres is the one which helped us in learning the flow process, and all along with Amol Kulkarni and Vivek Ranade from there. And I thank you for listening to me. If anything is there, you can visit the homepage, keep information on this. Which we're going to start in that domain now. So we have not made it yet, but we have all the tools now. Just need a good student to just push it. So
the question is, do you think one of the problems that these things have, I suppose, is there's a wide distribution in the sizes.
Sizes, yeah.
So does this flow method?
We should be in a position to, that's what my idea, whole idea is. Can I get a mono disperse? I will never get a mono disperse, but I'll get close to that. Plus, every time I make, it should be the same batch of quantum dots. So that's the idea. So in this polyaniline, we get very homogeneous nanofibers. But now the tools, it took a long time to set up these tools. So now we have tools ready and we have money ready. Now just need one or two good students. So that's the idea. Now next 6 months to a year, we will be having these quantum dots. And then once I have it, of course, I'll be approaching you guys to help me with that, how good or bad they are, to look into that. But that's our next full project on nanoparticle synthesis through flow process. And they will be in a, we will make them in as large batch as possible, as much as required. And every time they should remain the same.
Yes, ma'am. You spoke about those handheld devices for detection of explosives. How do they actually work?
So there's a polymer coated. I'll show you the device. Okay, this device. There's a capillary tube over here. That capillary tube, we coat the polymer inside the capillary tube. That polymer fluoresces. Okay, so there's an LED light from this side, and there's a detector, CMOS detector on the back side. And that fluorescence continues till there's no explosive in the air. So if you have TNT or RDX, immediately the fluorescence quenches, and you get a, so that you get a readout, both audio and video, audible and visible signal out, and it gives you an alarm. And whenever this tube, if there's no detection happens, it'll die off because of photo bleaching after some time. So there's a sensor which tells you that the tube is no more active, you need to change it. So all those features are built in. You just open this knob, pull the tube out and replace another tube. So the heart of it is a fluorescence quenching, which happens, and these are bulbs connected in series, so they become extremely sensitive. This device detects TNT at a femtosecond, femtogram level, which is much better than a dog, and it detects in split seconds. Only issue here is, like dog, most of the times you don't even know how dogs work. So they have been trained not to smell only explosives, but they smell a combination of things, but they can always reach where this is coming. This case also, you need to have a smell in the air. If there's no smell, is completely concealed, neither a dog nor this can figure it out. But most of these activities are done by few people, and you can't wash off that. If you handle TNT, it will take you long time to wash off that TNT. So we do the experiment. What we have done is we have taken a sample vial, we put TNT particle in that, and next day we throw that particle. Now tube is empty, and I've been using that tube for more than a year, and it still detects it. That low concentration is enough. And the idea here is, now can I make different coatings now, so that I can have all substance abuse, and particularly the interest is in biomedical application of breath analysis. Can that be done using this vapor detection? So this is a platform right now. At this stage, I call it a handheld platform for vapor detection through fluorescence. This should be now in a position to do all substance abuse. That's the next step. So that's a principle. Does it answer?
Why wouldn't it work for ammonium nitrate?
But it has to have your energy levels have to match. So there's a homolevel level of the polymer, and once you shine light on it, the electron goes into the excited state. And if your analyte has a receptive level, low lumo level below that, then this can happen. There's a one possibility of transfer. So either it has to have energy transfer or electron transfer. And ammonium nitrate does not have a level which is matched, and there's no energy transfer in case of ammonium nitrate. So for each analyte, you need to design a polymer. And since polymer is easy to design, so-called easy to design, you have to work into various combination and see which one will work. So we are not saying it will not be possible, but it will take us some time to come on. So now, once the device is ready, we are going to make this device commercially available, so that anybody who works in sensor, biomedical or drug abuse or explosive, should test their own material. And then we want to just create this whole thing in the country, so that not necessary, we only have to come out. They can come out with a new material. But right now, no, they can't even test it, even if they have it, a new material. So this is the way we are hoping that the activity will just pull in. They're very smart chemists, but once they have these devices, we should be in a position to put together. So, but the material has to be developed for that also. For each analyte, you need to develop then. Then you can have multiple channel or multiple coatings in a tube. Those are become technology related issues. It's so funny, the material is the core of it. Once everything is done, material costs nothing here. So the whole device, if costs 100 rupees, material will not, they won't cost, material guy will be given more, not more than 2 paisa. Okay, but without that, it won't work. That's the way is all that final product which comes out, the replacement cost of this will be the least one they will worry about, and they'll respect that much. Rest everything is the development and the management, and the sale will take you long more money than developing the device.
How do you ensure that it takes only TNT and nothing?
Yeah, so we do all types of tests. So in this case, it is an energy transfer. So the homolevel level has to match. It has to bind, come into the Fred distance. So first it has to fluoresce in solid state, then the energy level has to match, and then it has to bind. When these three happen, then only the energy transfer will happen. In this case that happens. So most of the things won't work. One thing, if you have a certain type of fragrance or a shoe polish, or a, in India, the best, what we surprise to us is essential oils give you a signal enhancement. So fluorescence does not quench, it enhances, which is very unusual, we never thought of it. So there's a commercial device available from US, Fido, and we bought that device for comparison and benchmarking it, and we realized essential oil that goes up. We asked them, they said they never tested essential oils there in US, but in India. And then we realized that in that case, the false positive which was coming was enhanced fluorescence. And now that's an easy way. Now you have a software built in and it looks into the fluorescence going up, it doesn't give you the alarm out. So you can look into the decay curves and other things, and that those are basically analytics can be built into the device. So we say that first thing you do, the moment you get a detection that is giving some indication that there's a suspicious object, then there's a protocol by which you follow. You change the tube, wash your hands, do that once more, and then look into the decay curve. And the decay curve will tell whether it's an RDX, TNT or something else. So those are all only the software part of it, hardware part of it can be looked into. But it's as good till you find somebody which interferes. So because I can't check everything possible on earth. So there's a very classical story. 10 years back, there was a company called SniffX based on cantilevers. So this AFM cantilevers, there's a company came up, Thomas Sundert from Kerala is an Oregon lab, developed whole platform, and this cantilever, when the explosive sits on it, the frequency changes, and he could delineate, show them that is a wonderful platform to make the explosive detection using cantilevers. It was tested in all possible application, company was floated in US, it was installed in all the airports. One fine day started giving the false positives. And then they found out that the new fragrance in the deodorant which people started using it, that had a false positive. And now you can't tell them not to use deodorants. So the whole company was shut down after full production and installation. So these things are good till they find a very detriment. So I still tell people, go for nature way, do a pattern recognition, make multiple receptors. But that's harder said than done. So there's a new platform which is now being developed by a Danish group. 10,000 cantilevers on a CD. And all are red. So laser, that your DVD writer, is a very powerful diagnostic tool. So they have made now this tens of thousands of cantilever on a disc, and they put it in that. There's a laser already, optical detector already built into. It reads all the cantilevers, and those patterns are becoming now a fingerprint region of this. But that's requires so much input of the processing side, the fabrication side, and then the readout side, and the analysis, and the pattern recognition. Those teams, if somebody can assemble it here, will be wonderful. But those are the ways you come out of this. So cantilevers are beautiful, but you require a pattern. Once this pattern recognition comes in, you will have a solution for all type of sensing.
Okay. So very interesting talk. Once again, let us thank.
Thank you.